Bon, welcome back. On va donc continuer avec la partie séminaire de cette session. Alors, comme je vous le disais tout à l'heure, cette partie séminaire va très bien compléter l'ensemble des cours, puisque j'ai très peu parlé de ces gaz d'électrons et ces liquides électroniques qui peuvent être formés soit à l'interface, soit à la surface libre de ces oxydes. C'est un très beau sujet sur lequel je suis en première approximation incompétent. Et donc je me suis appuyé sur deux séminaristes pour nous parler de ces sujets. D'une part Jean-Marc Triscone pour les gaz d'électrons à l'interface LAOSTO. Et donc aujourd'hui André Santander pour nous parler de sa découverte et de son étude par ARPES de ces gaz d'électrons libres à la surface de STO et d'autres matériaux. Alors, Andrés, c'est quelqu'un que je connais depuis longtemps. Il a fait sa thèse à l'ESPCI avec Nicole Bontemps, puis un postdoc dans lequel il s'est familiarisé avec les techniques ARPES dans le groupe de Juan Carlos Campuzano à Argonne et Chicago. Et puis ensuite, retour en France au laboratoire de physique des solides d'Orsay. Et il est maintenant au CSNSM, je ne vais pas me risquer à dire, à expliciter les abréviations, où il poursuit un programme de recherche sur la spectroscopie ARPES des matériaux fortement corrélés. Et donc, dans ces dernières années, ces gaz d'électrons et liquides d'électrons corrélés 2D. Voilà, je lui passe la parole en le remerciant d'être venu nous donner ce séminaire.
Merci beaucoup. Merci, Antoine. Good morning, everybody. I'll switch to English because I think some of you are more comfortable in English. But of course, anytime, don't hesitate to ask questions in either language as you wish. I'm very happy to be here today. It's really very nice and an honor to be speaking to you here in the framework of these lectures at Collège de France. As Antoine introduced, I will be speaking about the work in our group in the latest years about the two-dimensional electron gases at the surface of transition metal oxides. We are working at CSNSM. It's a lab whose name is unpronounceable, whatever the language you choose. It means Centre de Sciences Nucléaires the Sciences de la Matière, Center for Nuclear Science and Material Science at Université Paris-Sud. Two figures that you see here, the two images, are actual experimental data. I will be coming back to them later. They represent here one and two quantum well states of free electrons at the surface of a transparent insulating oxide that is represented here. And this is the Fermi surface of another of these two-dimensional electron liquids in one surface that was particularly oriented to get this peculiar topology. I will also be speaking about that. Before entering into details, let me first of all thank the members of our team, with whom this work would have been impossible. Most of the work that I will be speaking about today was the subject of the PhD thesis of Cédric Bareille and Tobias Rodel. Right now, we have also two PhD students, Sung Han Tsai and Ji Dai. We collaborate a lot with researchers from Synchrotron Soleil, in particular François Bertrand and Patrick Lefebvre, and our group is composed of four permanent researchers. We recently hired Emmanuel Franceskakis, Shamashi Sengupta, and our group is a two-headed group, jointly headed by Frank Fortuna and myself. And we have a lot of collaborations also with people in the area of Paris Sud. In particular, we have very strong collaborations with theoreticians at LPS, Marc Gabay, Marcelo Rosenberg, with researchers at Institut Électronique Fondamentale, who recently changed its name to CEDUSEN, Centre de Nanosciences et Nanotechnologie, and at Laboratoire Thales. Okay, contrary to Antoine, I will do the Garcia Marquez style. I will end with the answer to all the questions that I will put in this seminar. I hope that at the end of this talk, I will be able to show you that something that has been considered in many areas of condensed matter physics as bothering can actually be turned to your advantage to take a, to control the properties of transition metal oxides, and that is impurities. In most areas in condensed matter physics, what you try to do is get rid of impurities and treat the pure material. However, in some cases, impurities can actually be very helpful, and this is the case of oxygen vacancies in transition metal oxides. I will show that oxygen vacancies can act as electron donors for the system. They can dope the conduction band of the material. They can also provide a mechanism for confining those electrons near the surface, so you will get a two-dimensional electron gas. They can even be helpful in tailoring the electronic structure at the surface of the material. And according to our latest experiments, they might even be at the origin of some magnetic phenomena in these otherwise insulating non-magnetic oxides. So what I hope I will be able to show is that oxygen vacancies are indeed a universal knob in many of these oxides that allows us to realize to the electron systems and control their electronic structure and henceforth their macroscopic properties. In the plateau area, we call this emerging field oxide electronics, or more abbreviated, oxytronics. Okay. To introduce a little bit more the subject, let me start with a slide that I think you saw already from the talk of Jean-Marc Triscon. This whole area of oxide electronics, one can fairly say that it really was boosted and started in 2004 when Otomo and Wang reported that at the interface of these two oxide insulators, lanthanum aluminate and strontium titanate, they could observe a two-dimensional electron gas. This is amazing for several reasons. The first is these two materials, as I already mentioned, are large band gap insulators. Just look at the gap of strontium titanate. It's 3 eV, which is about six times the temperature at the surface of the sun. So there is no way that strontium titanate on Earth, or even close to the sun, can become a conductor by thermal doping before it melts. And lanthanum aluminate is even worse. Yet, again, at the interface of these two materials, the electronic structure reconstructs, and there is a metallic two-dimensional state. And moreover, as was reported by several teams, including the team of Jean-Marc Triscon, you can tune the fundamental, the ground state of that two-dimensional electronic system, for instance, by applying a gate on the back part of the strontium titanate, and you can make the system go from conductor to, or more likely insulator to conductor, and then to superconductor at low temperatures. So this is very nice. This is a prime example of the kind of things that you can do with transition metal oxides that will be impossible to do with standard semiconductor physics. Indeed, two-dimensional electron gases, for instance, in semiconductor heterostructures, are the building block of today's technology. So the fact that we could have two-dimensional electron gases in correlated oxides, where we have many remarkable properties not found in semiconductors, could be really interesting for applications. And in this sense, it is very handy that this 2D electron gas is found in the strontium titanate, because strontium titanate is somehow the silicon of oxides. You can grow almost anything on top, any other oxide on top of strontium titanate. However, at least for the moment, there are two questions that I will not try to answer here that somehow limit the possible utilization and applications of this interfacial to the electron gas. The first is, it is not yet clear, or at least there is no consensus about the microscopic origin of this electronic reconstruction at this interface. And the second is a practical limitation. Anyone who does heterepitaxial growth knows how expensive it is to grow these heterostructures. You need an equipment that is worth about 1 million euros in order to be able to grow a few of these heterostructures of 1 by 1 centimeter per week at most. So there is no way we could do a revolution in industry with this kind of techniques. I hopefully will show you later that with the surface to the electron gases in transition metal oxides, we might be able to overcome these two technological bottlenecks. Okay, let me again start by answering questions. What we found, and it was a little bit by accident and it was a big surprise, is that a two-dimensional electron gas can actually form spontaneously in vacuum at the bare surface of strontium titanate. You don't need to put any lanthanum aluminate on top of it to obtain a 2D electron gas. In this case, because the 2D electron gas, it is at the surface, we can study it with experimental techniques that are very sensitive to the surface, that usually are not well suited to study interfaces, but in this case is really the best case scenario, and therefore we can directly measure the band structure and many microscopic properties of these 2D electron gases and compare them with what is inferred from transport experiments in interfaces. And in our case, it turns out that the mechanism of formation, and this comes back to one of the questions that Mark asked to Antoine, the mechanism of formation of that 2D electron gas, we believe it's well understood. And I will tell you right ahead what it is. It's oxygen vacancies. It turns out that it is very easy to form oxygen vacancies in many oxides, and strontium titanate is one of the best examples of that. These vacancies will form, depending on the conditions, most of the times preferably close to the surface. Each vacancy provides two electrons that can dope the conduction band. And furthermore, each oxygen vacancy is like a, because it has lost the two electrons that the oxygen had, is like a positive center. And when you have many oxygen vacancies near the surface, this is like having a charged positive surface that will confine the electrons they release close to the surface. So the oxygen vacancies provide both the doping and the confining mechanism. And the moment you understand that mechanism, you can try to use it to your advantage to create 2D electron gases in other oxides. So this is essentially, in a way, the plan of the talk that I will be given in the next slides. Before talking about the results, let me make a one slide introduction or reminder about the experimental technique we have mostly used to study these systems. It is called angle resolve photoemission spectroscopy, and is based in the kind of experiment that gave birth to quantum mechanics, namely the photoelectric effect. So you have, we have monochromatic photons coming either from a synchrotron or from a gas discharge lamp. Those photons excite electrons from the material, at the surface of the material. And by energy conservation, because we know the photon energy, we can actually know the work function at the surface of the material, and we can measure by a kinetic energy analyzer the kinetic energy of the outgoing electrons. We can infer the binding energy of the electrons inside the solid. Furthermore, we can measure the angle of takeoff of the electrons from the surface. And by momentum conservation, at least parallel to the surface, because in the direction parallel to the surface, the translational symmetry is not broken, momentum is conserved. So parallel to the surface by momentum conservation, we can infer with the measurement of this takeoff angle the momentum of the electron inside the solid. The component perpendicular to the surface is a little bit more tricky, but when you have a two-dimensional electron system, you don't really care about that, because then you have all what you need to unravel the electronic structure of the electrons in the material. And this is a beautiful example of how it works. This is what is predicted to be a surface state at the 111 surface of metallic copper. It's just a revolution paraboloid. And actually, when you measure it, you indeed obtain that. What you see here is, in false color, the probability of having an electron as a function of its binding energy and momentum. Largest probability is red, lowest probability is blue. And you see how beautiful the parabola of free electron appears, cut off at the Fermi level. The electrons occupy all the states up to the Fermi level. And then if you put together all the states at the Fermi level for different momenta, you get a beautiful circular Fermi surface, exactly as the theory predicts. So indeed, this technique, ARPES, is very powerful to allow us to study the electronic structure near the surface of materials. Before telling you what we find in strontium titanate, let me come back to the sort of considerations that Antoine was doing in his lecture before. How is built the conduction band of strontium titanate? Well, actually, the orbitals that are important for this material are the T2G orbitals. So DXY, DYZ, DXZ. Let me consider, for instance, the DXY orbitals that are depicted here. These are the orbitals in different titanium sites in the XY plane, and this is one in the next plane. You see that the orbitals will overlap considerably well along the X or Y directions. This means that along those directions, you will have two light bands coming from the overlap of, for instance, the DXY orbital and the other orbital that I didn't depict, the DYZ, for instance, along the Y direction. There is also a good overlap. And along each direction, there is also a bad overlap between some of those orbitals. This will create a heavy band. And by cubic symmetry, the material is cubic, at least at high temperature, then you will have the same picture along each direction, namely two light bands that are fully degenerate and one heavy band, and the three of them are degenerate at the gamma point. Now, suppose by some mechanism, you are able to confine those electrons near the surface of the material. Confinement means you put the electrons in a quantum well. The shape of the quantum well doesn't really matter for the moment. You can assume that it's a square. I put triangular here because it's a little bit more realistic. What matters is, from quantum mechanics, we have learned that the eigenenergies of electrons confined in a quantum well are not only proportional to some power of the quantum well number, but also inversely proportional to the mass of the electrons along the confinement direction. And the power depends on the shape of the quantum well. Now, because electrons have different effective masses in solids along given directions, this will break the degeneracy that you have here. The confinement will break this degeneracy. And what you will have is that the band that is the heaviest along the confinement direction, say Z, so it's the DXY band that is light in the plane but is heavy out of plane, it will become the ground state, the one with the lowest energy. And then you will have a ladder of subbands that are DYZ, DXZ partners, and further degeneracies can be broken if, for instance, you consider spin orbit coupling or tetragonal or orthorhombic distortions in the material. So at the end, what you expect for a 2D electron gas confined near the surface of this material is something that looks like this. Some circles at the center and some cigars along the X and Y directions. Let us now go to experiments. That is indeed what we observe. So these are actual angle results for emission experiments at the surface of insulating strontium titanate. You can see an image of the sample we actually studied here. It's a transparent insulator. It should not work. If you talk to anyone that does for emission or tunneling or any of the electronic spectroscopy techniques, they will immediately tell you, you need to study metallic samples. An insulating sample will never work. Your surface will charge the moment you start kicking out electrons. Yet it works, despite the fact that the sample in the bulk is insulating. At the surface, we have beautiful light and heavy parabolas. We say light and heavy from the concavity or the second derivative of the parabola. At the surface of the material, and you see that this beautifully reproduces the band structure that we naively predicted just from basic considerations. So there are light and heavy electrons at the surface of a strontium titanate, and they create two circular and two cigar-like Fermi surfaces at the surface of this material. And if we make again a naive representation of the confinement as a triangular quantum well state, we can do reverse engineering of the problem, because the solutions of the Schrödinger equation to this quantum well are well known. Then, and because experimentally we know the energies at the bottom of the different bands and the effective masses, we can plug everything into the Schrödinger equation. And we obtain that this corresponds to electrons that are confined in a triangular quantum well whose depth is of the order of 300 millivolts, with an electric field that will be of the order of 80 megavolts per meter, and a separation or a width of the quantum well that is of the order of 4 unit cells. So this is indeed quantum mechanically confined. It's two-dimensional in the sense of quantum mechanics. Okay. As I mentioned at the beginning, we know that these states at the surface of a strontium titanate arise from oxygen vacancies that are created near the surface. And actually, the proof of that came 10 years before we actually observed that. So it was lying there all the time. These are experiments that were done in 2002 by Ayura and collaborators, still at the surface of a strontium titanate. So what they are showing here is angle integrated for emission data. You can sort of interpret it as the density of states of the material. So what you see here is the for emission intensity as a function of binding energy over a wide energy scale that includes the valence band of oxygen 2p states. And if we zoom in near the Fermi level, we can see a large sharp peak. Today we know that that large sharp peak is the two-dimensional electron gas at the surface of a strontium titanate, and another state lying at about 1.3 electron volts below the Fermi level. At that time it was not really well understood what was the origin of that state. Today we know that it comes from oxygen vacancies. Anyway, the interesting thing of this experiment was the following. Those researchers were suspecting that many of the observations were indeed related to oxygen vacancies. So what they did is to let, in purpose, enter oxygen into the ultra-high vacuum chamber of the measurements, and this is what happens. This is the original state, and this is after the position of 0.1 Langmuir. This is a unit to measure coverage of a surface of oxygen, and so forth and so on. And you see that when you deposit oxygen, three things happen. The first thing is that the intense peak at the Fermi level disappears. The second thing is that this state, 1.5 eV below the Fermi level, also disappears. And the third thing is that the valence band of oxygen states that at the beginning was this full line shifts towards the Fermi level by about 200 millivolts. This means that when the surface had oxygen vacancies before the position of oxygen, you had a band bending of all the states. It's like the surface had a potential well that was pulling down in energy all the states by about 200 millivolts, which is exactly the order of magnitude of the energy we observe here for pulling down this conduction band below the Fermi level. So this is very nice. This means that with oxygen vacancies, we can create, we can dope the conduction band of a strontium titanate, and we can confine those electrons near the surface. The moment we understand that, we can ask ourselves the following question. Can this mechanism, because creating oxygen vacancies is so easy in many oxides, can it be generalized to other oxides? And the answer is yes, it can be done. So we have done it already in several other oxides. I will not go into many details here. I was just want to show some of the materials in which it works. So this was most of the thesis of Cedric and Tobias. One material in which it works very nicely is potassium tantalate. The interest we had in potassium tantalate is that tantalum is much heavier than titanium. Henceforth, it has a stronger spin orbit coupling. Actually, the atomic spin orbit coupling of tantalum is of the order of 300 or 400 millielectronvolts. That of strontium titanate is just at most 10 to 20 millielectronvolts. And you see that indeed, whereas the sample is again insulated and transparent, we observe conducting states at the surface of the material. But see how different these states look from the states at the surface of a strontium titanate. Actually, here it turns out that you have at least three different effective masses, one very light, one that we call intermediate, and one very heavy. All of them are due in part to the strong spin orbit coupling of this material. And as I said, I will not enter into much details, but one interesting outcome of these studies is that this band structure turns out to be directly related to the fact that many energy scales become comparable in this material. And this is a situation that is very interesting in physics. Namely, the spin orbit coupling that I mentioned is of the order of 300 millivolts, is comparable to the filling of the band, and is comparable to the splitting between different energies due to confinement. So when all those energy scales enter into competition, the electronic structure at the surface completely reconstructs from what you will expect in the bulk. Another material in which it beautifully works is anatas. Anatas is one of the forms of titanium O2, which is actually a material that is already used today for many important applications. For instance, when you use solar cream to avoid being sunburned, the solar cream has nanoparticles of anatas, which absorb the ultraviolet light, and this is important to avoid that ultraviolet light goes to your cells instead. So it turns out that if you irradiate anatas with ultraviolet light, actually you create a 2D electron gas at the surface, and even more, if you irradiate too much, you can create so much oxygen vacancies that the disorder kills the 2D electron gas. This is what happened here. What you can do is put the ultraviolet beam in a different spot in the sample, and you will create again a 2D electron gas. So this will be a way to write conductive paths at the surface of an insulating material. Of course, it is a very complicated way to do that, but still it's fun to know that oxygen vacancies can create, destroy, or recreate the 2D electron gas at the surface of this material. Okay, the moment you know that you can do all these games at the surface of the oxides, you can also say, okay, let us play, let us do something that you can do at the surface that cannot be done at the bulk. Yes?
Just a question, Andres. So when you describe creating this gas with light, so it's a permanent thing. You irradiate, it creates the vacancies, and the gas is there.
And yes. And the only way to kill that gas is to refill the vacancies, which is done, for instance, if you take the sample out to air. So that is, for a moment, but I will come back to that at the end of my talk, a practical limitation of these 2D electron gases. But because they live at the surface, you can do, with the surface, you can do many things that you cannot in the bulk, right? Imagine an orange. An orange is a sphere, no matter from which direction you look at it. But if you are at the surface and you break the three-dimensional symmetry, then different surfaces of a material show different topologies. Imagine a cube. A cube, one of the principal, one of the main faces has a square symmetry, but if you look at 1-1-1 cut of the cube, you will have a threefold symmetry. So this is exactly the kind of game that we did. To be more precise, let us consider again, for instance, potassium tantalate. Potassium tantalate is a cubic perovskite. In this cartoon, I have taken away all the atoms except the tantalum atoms, which are the ones that ultimately matter for understanding the electronic structure. They occupy the corners of a cube, and I have artificially colored them so that green represent one layer along 1-1-1 direction, blue another layer, and red another layer. Let's imagine now that we are able to confine electrons in the first layer of this material. We will have electrons that see a crystal with threefold symmetry like this. The interesting case comes next. What if we are able to confine those electrons in two layers? Then they will see locally a crystalline structure that looks like the one of graphene. And actually, our work was inspired by a work of theoreticians in the group of Okamoto that had predicted that in this way, it might be possible to realize non-trivial topological states at the surface of these oxides by confining electrons along the 1-1-1 direction in these materials. Okay, for the moment we cannot control along how many layers we can confine the electrons, so it might happen that we confine in three or more layers. In that case, we come back to the case of the threefold symmetry, but I will say that confining in two layers is for the moment a secondary question. The primary question that we wanted to ask at that time is, can we even confine electrons along the 1-1-1 direction in cubic perovskites? And the question is highly non-trivial. If I come back to the formula that Antoine wrote here for transition metal oxides, forget about nickel, replace nickel by any transition metal. No matter what R and transition metal you have here, for any transition metal oxide of formula R transition metal O3, if you consider the 1-1-1 surface, it will always be highly polar, meaning that you will have either tantalum or R oxygen atoms, and any combination will be highly polar. And nature doesn't like highly polar surfaces, so the first thing you can imagine will happen is that the surface will reconstruct, and it's not even evident that you will be able to do something with that surface. Well, the worst experiment is the one that you don't do. So we did the experiment, and actually it works, again, to our surprise. So it works in two cases, potassium tantalate and strontium titanate. This is the example of strontium titanate. So this is, again, a 2D electron gas, this time at the 1-1-1 surface of strontium titanate. And you see how beautiful the Fermi surface looks. It's like the cartoon we made when we were kids of an atom. So it's really a threefold symmetric Fermi surface, and what we are, one of the things we are trying to do now is play with the feeling of these states to see if we can arrive to a feeling in which the electrons occupy the two surface layers of the material. And one interesting outcome of this is that if you look along the 1-1-1 direction in a cube, this direction is the same for all the orbitals, right? So that means that you should not have any more, or in other words, the effective mass of the orbitals is the same along the 1-1-1 direction. And indeed, there is no more degeneracy break at the gamma point along that direction. Okay, so far so good. There is another interesting consequence of having oxygen vacancies that actually has been discussed from several years, which is the possible magnetic effects of oxygen vacancies at these non-magnetic oxides. Actually, there were already observations about six or 7 years ago that at the interfaces of lanthanum aluminate and strontium titanate, and probably Jean-Marc Triscon spoke about this in his talk, you can observe at low temperature magnetic dipoles. So this is one of the experiments that observed that. This is the LAO-STO interface. This was proved by a micrometric squid. This is the size of the squid scanner. And what you see here is different dipoles appearing at low temperature of the material. So we ask ourselves, could it be that in the 2D electron gases that we observe at the surface of these transition metal oxides, we also see magnetic states? Could those states be related to oxygen vacancies? To attack that question, we did a work in collaboration with the laser spectroscopy group of Professor Shin at the Institute of Solid State Physics in Tokyo. In particular, we use an instrument that was put together beautifully by this young researcher, Toshi Taniuchi. It's called a laser photoelectron microscope. Photoelectron microscopy is actually a well-known technique. It is used since many, many years in synchrotrons. It's based, again, on the photoelectric effect. So electrons are ejected from the sample, usually by X-ray or high-energy photons. And then what you do is you detect the different core levels in the spectra of those electrons, and you can detect with a very high spatial resolution where are the different elements in your system. Here, what they do is the same technique, but using lasers, so very low photon energy, as the exciting light field. And because the photon energy is so low, electrons can only be excited from the conduction band of the system. The energy of the photon is not enough to be able to excite electrons from the valence band. It's not enough to overcome the work function of the material. So this type of microscopy proves only whatever is at the conduction band of the material. And furthermore, if you use it in dichroic mode, meaning that you shine with alternatively right-handed and left-handed polarized light, you can also measure the magnetic states due to the conduction electrons at the surface of the material. And because these researchers have worked out very well their instrumentation, the spatial resolution in their case is of the order of 5 nanometers. So with a resolution of 5 nanometers, in principle, with this instrument, we can prove the presence of magnetic states in the conduction band of the material. This is an example of a well-known magnetic material. Iron platinum looked with this laser beam technique. So you can see here the different domains. So what we did is apply this laser beam technique to the surface of strontium titanate. Again, here you can barely see it, but there is the material we studied, so it's a transparent insulator. This is a microscope picture. This is the scale, 500 nanometers, in real space. So what you see are terraces that are the atomic step terraces typical at the surface of these oxides. And if we now look at the dichroic laser photoemission signal at room temperature, what you see is different blue and red domains, which mean different magnetic orientations. If we warm up the sample to 1000 Kelvin, you see the image. I don't know if you can see it, but there is an image here. The contrast has essentially gone. Everything is homogeneous. So there are indeed magnetic domains, even at room temperature, at the surface of this material, which was pre-annealed in vacuum before the experiments, meaning by annealing we heat at high temperature to create vacancies. And this indeed proves that vacancies are somehow related to the presence of magnetic states, even at room temperature. To confirm that this was indeed magnetic, we did the following experiment. We first started from the sample at room temperature. Then we warmed it up to something like 700 Kelvin, applied a magnetic field perpendicular to the surface, cooled down under magnetic field. Unfortunately for emission, for many reasons, cannot be done under magnetic field. One reason is that electrons being charged particles, if you have a magnetic field on, they will spin around the magnetic field and you will lose them for the detection. So we need to turn off the field for measurements. But after this experiment of cooling down in magnetic field, you see that the contrast has increased when you measure again the sample at room temperature. So this somehow is a proof that whatever we are observing seems to be indeed related to the presence of oxygen vacancies. So far so good. Oxygen vacancies can dope the conduction band of transition metal oxides, can confine those electrons near the surface, and then create 2D electron gases. The mechanism can be generalized to several transition metal oxides, and these vacancies seem to be responsible for the presence of magnetic states. All that is very beautiful, but as to this point, is absolutely useless. Because the moment you take the sample out to air, all that physics is gone. Oxygen will refill the vacancies, and everything is lost for eternity. So something that was turning around our head since the moment we first observed a two-dimensional electron gas is, what can we do to still have fun with all this physics but be able to maintain those 2D electron gases alive in room temperature at ambient pressure? So the answer was actually very simple and very elegant, and it came from an idea of my collaborator, Frank Fortuna. It is the following. Let us deposit just something, some metal that oxidizes very easily at the surface of the material in ultra-high vacuum. Because in ultra-high vacuum there is no oxygen, but if this metal oxidizes very easily, it will look for oxygen in the material, and by doing that, it will pump oxygen, it will oxidize, and it will create a 2D electron gas. And it actually works. So what we did is depositing aluminum at the surface of strontium titanate. Aluminum transforms into aluminum oxide, which is an insulator. That's very handy because you don't want a metal to shortcut the 2D electron gas that you have below. It will also protect the 2D electron gas from reoxygenation when you take it out to air. And this is the experimental proof that indeed it creates a 2D electron gas. So this is, and again, an ARPES experiment through this very thin interface of 2 angstrom of aluminum oxide obtained after deposition of aluminum. And you see that there is a beautiful 2D electron gas. It is so homogeneous and so much more perfectly done than in the previous cases that you can even see, I will not enter into details unless you want to ask some questions at the end. If you have good eyes, you can see here a change in the slope of the spectra and a sudden change also of intensity. This is electron-phonon coupling. This is the microscopic signature of electron-phonon coupling. So, yes?
So what you are saying is that there is actual ionic migration of oxygen from the TMO to the aluminum.
Yes, and this was done in conditions that are much more cheaper than any PLD. This is done at room temperature. The evaporation is just thermal evaporation. We don't care about having epitaxial growth. This is disorder, and it's done at room temperature. So we obtain the same 2D electron gas for, the cost of all this material can be about 10 kilo euros instead of 1 million euro. And then it costs less than 5 euros to produce this thing. So it is indeed something that we hope can break all the limitations that I spoke about at the beginning of my talk. Indeed, so these are different experiments to prove that what we obtain is indeed oxidized aluminum after deposition of metallic aluminum in several materials. So, for instance, if we deposit only, so this is the 2p core level of aluminum, and there is a huge difference between the oxidized aluminum and metallic aluminum. If we deposit only 2 angstrom of aluminum, you get this red peak. If you deposit 6 angstrom of aluminum, then the latest layers of aluminum will be metallic again. They don't absorb oxygen anymore, and you get the metallic aluminum. So indeed, aluminum is getting oxidized when you deposit it at the surface of the material. The moment you take even the 6 angstrom sample out to air, all the aluminum will oxidize anyway. So this is very good because you will get anyway an insulator that is protecting the 2D electron gas. And because we were able to do that, we were able to do, for the first time, a real small demonstration device based on these 2D electron gases at the surface of these materials. So this is using barium titanate, which is a ferroelectric insulator. It was grown on strontium titanate, and to show that it's ferroelectric, this is an image obtained with a piezoelectric force microscopy. So what you have is like an AFM, but the tip can be polarized, and you approach it to the surface, and then you can also polarize the domains if the surface indeed is ferroelectric. So you see that we can write different domains with different polarizations. And then we deposit aluminum on top of it, and we can beautifully see the formation of a 2D electron gas at the surface of this otherwise ferroelectric insulator. I think there is a theorem by Anderson that says that it is forbidden or contradictory to have a ferroelectric that is conductive. You can imagine why. In order to have ferroelectricity, you need to be able to polarize the material. But if you have conduction electrons, then you will not have any polarization anymore. So what we obtain here is not a metallic state in the bulk ferroelectric insulator. What we have is like two different materials that coexist after the creation of vacancies, a conductive state at the surface of an otherwise insulating ferroelectric material. When we take the sample out to air to prove that the bulk is still ferroelectric so that we have a functionality that can be addressed by the 2D electron gas at the surface, we did experiments of capacitance as a function of bias, and we still see the typical hysteresis of ferroelectric materials. So this is very nice. This means that indeed we can use to our advantage this new technique to try to create 2D electron gases in many of these functional oxides and go toward real transfer measurements and devices. And this has been actually the work in the last year of one of our young collaborators, Shamashi Sengupta. So we have been now studying in the group the transport properties of these 2D electron gases. This is one of the samples that Shamashi studied. The dots that you see here are the contacts, and you can see the wires coming out. So I guess that also you saw a lot of these type of measurements in the talk of Jean-Marc Triscon. What we are doing for the moment is try to reproduce the same type of measurements as in the interfaces, but this time at the surface of a strontium titanate. What you see here is the hole resistance as a function of magnetic field, and it's a beautiful straight line. From this slope, you can deduce the mobility of the 2D electron gas, and then we can measure that as a function of temperature. It's of the same order of magnitude of the mobilities that you obtain in most of those interfaces. And even more, we could observe also superconductivity in this 2D electron gas at the surface of strontium titanate. And you see that, so this is as a function of applied magnetic field, and you see that the maximum TC is of the order of 400 millikelvin, which is larger than the maximum TC that you obtain at the lanthanum aluminate strontium titanate interface. And we believe that this is due to the fact that in our case, even if we create this 2D electron gas by oxygen vacancies, it is more spatially homogeneous than the 2D electron gas in the interfaces. By the way, this was already known. Other teams had played before us to deposit amorphous lanthanum aluminate on strontium titanate, and they obtained comparable TCs of 400 millikelvin. Okay. We can play not only with the 2D electron gas by depositing some metal, by depositing aluminum, but we can actually go beyond and say, okay, what if we deposit a metal that is less stupid than aluminum? A metal that not only wants to pump oxygen to oxidize, but that when oxidizing, the material itself becomes functional. And this is what we did in collaboration with researchers in the group of Martina Müller in Jülich. We deposited europium at the surface of strontium titanate. Europium also oxidizes very easily. And it turns out that it works. You deposit europium, it becomes europium oxide. It creates the 2D electron gas at the surface of STO. And then you take the sample out to air, and indeed, there is magnetism that is characteristic of the europium oxide layer. So what we are expecting with this new technique is to be able also to create capping layers that can allow us to produce that two-dimensional electron gas to protect, but also to add functionalities that go beyond what you can do with the 2D electron gas in the oxide itself. So with this, I will conclude. And then, if you allow me 5 more minutes, I will show you something very fun. Let me show my conclusions in the form of plots. I hope to have convinced you that the oxide surfaces can be considered as new materials in which you can play a lot. You can create two-dimensional electron gases in different materials. They show electronic structure that is not necessarily the same you will infer from the bulk. You can play with the surface topology and even tailor 2D electron gases that are completely new, that don't even exist in the bulk. You can find that oxygen vacancies can somehow be used to create magnetic states at the surface of these systems. And with the new technique of thermal evaporation of metals, we hope to be able to go beyond and create really useful devices that can be used at ambient conditions. So this is really a new, very fun playground for fundamental and applied physics. And of course, if you are interested in interacting with us, please don't hesitate to contact us. Do you know this is Super Dupont, the French national superhero? Okay, thanks a lot. And if you allow me 5 more minutes, is that okay? Okay, so now, because we are talking about oxygen vacancies, and because Antoine was mentioning a lot the light-induced changes in transition metal oxides, let me show you one corollary of the work we have been doing that is related to light-induced nightmares for condensed matter physicists, theoreticians. And this goes back to something that I think is very fond to Antoine and to all the theoreticians here, and I see Silke also laughing over there. Strontium vanadate. I think probably strontium vanadate came in every lecture of Antoine because it's one of the most fundamental transition metal oxides. It's the paradigmatic correlated metal. And it has been really studied a lot, both theoretically and experimentally, in the last, I don't know, 30 years, to try to use it as the founding stone for correlated electron physics. Let me show you why. If we go into more detail into the electronic structure of correlated metals. If a system is not correlated, we know already that you have one band, right? The band picture of a material. It will be represented just by Dirac peaks if you represent the spectral function as a function of momentum and energy. But if you have a correlated material, part of the spectral weight of this quasi-particle will actually be transferred to the Mott-Hoover band. So in a correlated electron system, you will have, and this is what you see in strontium vanadate, a conduction band that is here, and a peak trailing behind that is the Mott-Hoover band, that is the direct signature of electron correlations. So far, so good. This has been observed since many years now in strontium vanadate, and it was a great victory, and it's really a beautiful example of correlated electron physics. However, many experiments had pointed out that there was something smelling not that good in that. For instance, if you change the photon energy at which you do the experiments, the ratio of the Mott-Hoover band to the quasi-particle peak will change. This ratio is supposed to be directly related to the intensity of correlations. So this is not nice. It cannot be that a thing that is supposed to be so tightly tied to fundamental physics depends on the experimental parameters that you use.
Well, of course, this was interpreted originally as sensitivity to the bulk versus...
Yeah, so a way to try to get out honorably of that dilemma is the surface has different correlations compared to the bulk. Now, let me scramble more the situation. This is a strontium titanate, which we spoke about the last 45 minutes. We see a beautiful quasi-particle peak and then this huge potato trailing behind. Yet strontium titanate is not a correlated transition metal oxide. But you see that the spectra look qualitatively very similar between strontium titanate and strontium vanadate. Go to Anatas, same picture. You have a peak at the Fermi level, and then another potato trailing behind. Why do we know, by the way, that strontium titanate is not correlated from a purely experimental point of view? Because the effective masses we get experimentally, we can measure them directly by ARPES, coincide exactly what will you expect from a pure tie binding calculation. So if there are correlations, they are really, really, really tiny. Potassium tantalate, same picture. You see a peak and then a potato trailing behind. Strontium vanadate, the paradigmatic material of correlations, same picture. So what is going on here? Do we have strong electron correlations, or have all of us, including theoreticians, been fooled all these years, and what we are observing is just oxygen vacancies? These are actually, at least in the case of strontium titanate, this we know today, peak is due to clusters of oxygen vacancies. And as any cluster, they behave like molecules with their own molecular states. And this is actually several molecular states that lie very close in energy and form this peak here. It has nothing to do with correlations. Okay, let me scare you even more. This is a strontium titanate. And it turns out that ultraviolet light can create oxygen vacancies very easily in this material. So at the beginning, when you just start shining the sample, is the blue curve here, you have nothing. And then when you just let the sample under the ultraviolet beam, with time, you have a quasi-particle peak that grows, and you have also this peak that grows. So this is a proof that light, with time, is creating impurity states in the material. This is a strontium vanadate. Similar, not quite exactly the same, but similar. Of course, this is a metal, so at the beginning, there is a metallic state at the Fermi level. But then you see that with time, the peak here that for so many years, for so many PhD and postdocs, and for so many permanent positions has been considered as a correlated Mott-Hoover state actually grows up with time, whereas the peak here doesn't really grow. This growth here is actually just due to the fact that the background is also increasing. So there is really no relation between this and this. Well, to try to sort of this, we work it in collaboration with theoreticians. We still believe and trust theoreticians for many of these things. Theoreticians in the group of José Valentí, in particular with Stephen Backes. I think Stephen is here. It turns out that indeed light can and will create a lot of oxygen vacancies in strontium vanadate. But if we use another synchrotron, so we went for experiments at photon factory where the light intensity is two orders of magnitude smaller than Soleil, you will say that's pretty bad for experiments, but sometimes it can be very good. Then at Keck, we saw that the spectra don't change with time, and then we could measure the what we consider to be the intrinsic spectrum of strontium vanadate, which is here, and then you can see that there is not only the conduction band, but also a small bump trailing behind. This will be the real signature of the Mott-Hoover band, and as you can see, if you do some data treatment, you can see that this Mott-Hoover band disperses a little bit, which indeed should happen because the Mott-Hoover band is part of the spectral function of the whole thing. So if the main band disperses, the Mott-Hoover band should disperse as well. Whereas when you have a lot of vacancies like in Soleil, then you have just a big potato in which the signal from vacancies becomes even larger than the intrinsic Mott-Hoover band and nothing disperses anymore. A different question that I will not try to answer, but actually you can go to this paper to look for more details, is why nature plays with us and the oxygen vacancies states fall just on top of the Mott-Hoover band. Maybe because nature doesn't love theoreticians. Sorry. So with that, thanks again. And of course, any questions are most welcome.